All right, here you go. Today's show in 5 words or less. Ought to give you a hint as to where we're going, actually. Oil, the Fed, college diversity. That's 5, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 9th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Stop me if you've heard me say this before, all right? Oil prices fell today a lot. Crude was down 5%, $28.23 a barrel at the close in New York. That's for the U.S. benchmark, by the way, West Texas Intermediate. The global standard, Brent North Sea crude, was down even more. One reason, in what we should say here, to be upfront, is a multivariable market. The International Energy Agency said today that the world's oversupply is going to be even more oversupplied, with Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia pumping full tilt. Here's another way to process all of this. The key Middle East members of OPEC have apparently decided they don't much care about managing their market and stabilizing their price. So have we perhaps arrived at a post-OPEC world? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
Until recently, OPEC has been a sort of central bank for oil, managing supply and stable prices. But no more, says analyst Bob McNally at the Rapidan Group. He says the cartel's been AWOL since 2008.
OPEC failed to prevent oil prices from spiking and contributing to a great recession. We're now paying attention because since October of 2014, OPEC has failed to put a floor under oil prices.
There are a couple of assumed reasons why. OPEC doesn't get along too well. And if key Arab producers pull back, two rivals are ready to pounce and steal customers, says Jamie Webster, oil markets director at IHS.
If they cut production, U.S. production could increase. And there's also a concern that Iranian production is starting to come back in a post-sanctions world.
So everybody's pumping. OPEC production is up, even as prices tank. You might think this is a natural state, a Darwinian free-for-all. But Alex Schindler at Energy Intelligence in London says no. For most of our 150-year age of oil, somebody has managed supply, either OPEC or Texas regulators or Standard Oil.
There's only been 2 times when oil was not being regulated by someone. To not have an active manager in the market is a major change for the oil industry, and I think that's why we're seeing such confusion about how to proceed.
There is talk in OPEC of a coordinated cut, perhaps with non-member Russia. But there are doubters. Some are already declaring a post-OPEC world. Is that good? Bob McNally isn't celebrating.
I have to invoke here an old Joan Jett song, "I Hate Myself for Loving You." The only thing worse than OPEC managing the market is OPEC not managing the market.
So buckle up. Could be a bumpy ride. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
OPEC and Joan Jett, there you go. All right, moving on. As of this writing, it has been 54 days since we've heard an on-the-record word from Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen. That streak, however, will come to a congressionally mandated end at 55 tomorrow. Dr. Yellen is going to be on Capitol Hill for her twice-yearly appearance before the relevant House and Senate oversight committees. It's always good to hear what's on her mind, seeing as how she basically runs the American economy right now. But it does take a little bit of zip out of the game that we like to play around here. All right, the game that I like to play, which is called What is Janet Yellen Thinking? The gimmick, of course, is that you got to do it in 5 words or less. While Dr. Yellen will undoubtedly take many multiples of that to get her points across tomorrow, we sent Marketplace's Sabree Benishour out to talk to some economists today about what they expect to hear.
What's Janet Yellen thinking? 5 words or less. Gad Levinon from the Conference Board.
Did I make a mistake?
As in, markets are so volatile right now, was it a bad idea to raise rates last year? Levinon's answer, which he also thinks is Yellen's answer, is...
I don't think so.
Similarly, Samir Samana with the Wells Fargo Institute hears Janet Yellen thinking this.
Markets need a deep breath.
Yellen's Fed is data dependent, he says, and Yellen is likely to point to a lot of data showing the markets are not the economy.
You've got a labor market that's pretty healthy. You've got additional wage gains, inflation that's still pretty benign. You've got a housing market that continues to rebound from its crisis lows. You've got consumer sentiment that's still at pretty good levels.
Yellen may also point out to Congress that the Fed's own models show the chances of recession in 2016 are about 3 to 5%. But it's still got to be at least a little hard to shake the sticky sense of gloom on Wall Street these days.
I have no doubt that within the Federal Reserve, there's a vigorous debate as to the extent to which monetary policy needs to be subordinate or subservient, really, to markets.
Richard DeKayser is with Wells Fargo & Company. He says, on the one hand, markets do influence the economy, but on the other, the Fed can't bail out investors just because they're having a bad time.
They don't want to basically underwrite portfolio managers.
In all likelihood, these economists say, the Fed may give it a few more months before raising rates again. Whatever Janet Yellen is thinking, she'll tell us tomorrow, and it'll be in more than five words. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
In keeping with the theme, here with Wall Street today in five words or less, very bouncy, could have been worse. Details, numbers, you know the drill. It's a reasonably safe bet that the R word is going to come up tomorrow in Janet Yellen's testimony. Recession is the word I'm thinking of here. In the statement after its December meeting, the Fed said it is worried about risks to the downside. As it happens, Neil Irwin, a senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, wrote about how, if it's going to happen, and we should stress it's still an if, but how a recession might arrive here. Neil Irwin, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
We should start probably with a caveat, right? This is a scenario. It's not what you believe is likely to happen, right?
That's right. We don't know exactly where the economy is going to go in 2016. This is talking about the kind of downside risk, the possibilities that are out there that we hope don't happen, but it increasingly looks like they could.
All right. So if the stars line up against us, what might those stars be? Just tick off a couple for me.
Well, it starts overseas. It starts in emerging markets where we've had really 15 years of dramatic capital inflows, and those are reversing now over the last year. So when money was coming in, a lot of problems got kind of glossed over. Now that money's going out, we're seeing huge debt problems in China, in Brazil, and a bunch of other emerging markets. So that's kind of the starting point, that we see this shift toward emerging markets overseas really contracting where they were growing for a long time.
And it leads to one of my favorite phrases in all of capitalism, Warren Buffett saying, you don't know who's swimming naked till the tide goes out, right?
That's right. Now, that said, this on its own shouldn't really affect the U.S. economy that much. You know, mm-hmm. We saw this back in 1998 when there was an emerging markets crisis. You know, the U.S. trade flows with Asia, with Latin America, they're big, but in the grand scheme of the U.S. economy, that shouldn't be enough to bring it down. It's not like U.S. banks are sitting on a lot of Chinese debt, anything like that. So if we're going to have a U.S. recession, it has to be something a little more complicated and something that channels through other pathways.
All right, so lay it out for me then, because it's not like we're all that exposed. How might this hit us in the fanny? I mean, what's different this time, I guess, is the question.
Well, it might not hit us in the fanny. We don't know that. But if it does, it's probably going to happen something like this. We're already seeing some real impacts on the U.S. industrial sector because of lower oil. There's less oil exploration. We're seeing less industrial activity, less exports because of the strong dollar, because of weaker economies overseas. Those alone aren't that big. We've still had strong job growth in the last year despite those factors. So the question, though, is as these forces build and get stronger, is the capacity of the U.S. to really deal with it limited? Mm-hmm. Is the Federal Reserve not in a place where it might have been years ago to combat any weakness, to lower rates? Could markets that are just down a little bit now really get out of control and fall? Those are the possibilities that could really lead the U.S. economy into a bad place.
How much of a problem is it that we are simply not growing as strongly as we used to and as strongly as we have historically?
Yeah, I mentioned the parallel with 1998 when there was an emerging markets crisis, there was an oil price collapse, and yet the U.S. economy did great in 1999. That was a great year for the United States. Well, there's a big difference. The trend line back then was a lot stronger. We were growing around 4-4.5% a year back in the late 90s. Now we've been growing 2-2.5%. So there's not as much of a cushion. If we do see a little bit of a slowdown, a little bit of a ripple, we could really see the bottom fall out and get into negative growth territory, a recession, much more easily now than we could have back in the 90s when the trend line was so much stronger.
One hates to put you on the spot, but one will anyway because I have you on the phone. Likelihood of any of this happening?
You know, Larry Summers, who's very smart about this stuff, thinks it's about a 1 in 3 chance of a recession this year. I'm a little more optimistic than Larry. I go more like 25%. But this is a tricky thing to guess. This is a very complex dynamic system. It's a $17 trillion economy with all these moving pieces. So saying that with any confidence is a fool's errand.
Neil Irwin is a senior economics correspondent at The New York Times. Neil, thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Mars Incorporated, maker of, among other things, M&M's, Skittles, and Snickers bars, says it's going to phase out all the artificial coloring in all of its, quote, human food products. I should note here that Mars makes pet food, too. The company's already been doing this on the human side in Europe, but Mars says it's responding to consumer demands here. People apparently want healthier choices even in their candies. Marketplace's Andy Euler picks it up from there.
You know when your kids eat Skittles and have a bright red stain on their mouths afterward? Well, they're still going to be susceptible to that. Only Mars says soon that dye is going to be all natural. Laura McCleary is a lawyer for the Center for Science and the Public Interest.
We just put out a report that looks at the scientific evidence and describes the emerging consensus that dyes are linked to behavioral problems in some children. And I think there's really a chorus growing to pressure companies to make these changes.
For a giant candy company like Mars, which posted $33 billion in revenue last year, the loudest members of that chorus are the people buying the products.
From the perspective of the consumer, it seems like a simple thing to do.
That's Carlos Torelli. He teaches marketing at the University of Minnesota.
It's part of a trend that many you know food companies now are becoming more and more conscious about.
But the colors of the candy are a big deal. Remember that nationwide vote to have blue replace tan M&Ms in the 90s? Today, people even argue about their second favorite color of Starburst. So coloring could be a logistical nightmare. John Carrier teaches system dynamics at MIT's Sloan School of Management.
It's going to be an inconsistent product now because it comes from nature. They've got to test it out and see what actually, when they make these candy bars, can they actually get a consistent color? Because have you ever seen a Milky Way bar that's the same color every time?
Mars has more than 50 brands under its portfolio and is giving itself 5 years to complete the switch. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Talented minority faculty are not unicorns. They're there. It just depends on where you're looking. You have to look.
You have to look pretty hard, it turns out. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 12 points today, less than a tenth percent, closed at 16,014. The NASDAQ off 15 points, about a third percent, finished at 4268. The S&P 500 down a single point, less than a tenth percent. 1,852. There's some corporate news to start us off with here. Viacom reported a worse-than-expected drop in revenue last quarter. Viacom owns, among other things, MTV, Comedy Central, and Paramount. The company said it was hurt by lower advertising sales and fewer hit movies. Viacom also said it struck a deal to sell ads on the messaging app Snapchat. Investors, however, seem more focused on the former than the latter. Shares tumbled 21%. Another hard day for energy stocks, which makes sense given the price of crude. Chevron fell 3.5%. ConocoPhillips off 2.4% today. Not all gloom and doom, though. The Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company said sales were good and costs were low last quarter. Investors liked that. Shares rolled up more than 4%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.72%. Follow the bond market, people. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The twice-yearly ritual known as New York Fashion Week starts on Thursday, but it's entirely possible it's not going to be the same kind of ritual much longer. Designers and fashion houses are having to change how they work as the economy changes around them. Elizabeth Holmes covers fashion and retail for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kai.
What are you expecting out of the shows this year? I mean, they're doing some changes this year at Fashion Week.
So Fashion Week is having a little bit of its own identity crisis right now. You know, for years and years and years, the model was a very sort of closed and exclusive system where clothes were shown 4, 5, 6 months in advance of when they'd actually show up in stores. And that gave buyers and editors time to sort of preview a collection, pick what they like, and then, you know, present it to the customer. Well, enter social media, which has kind of blown up this whole model. And anybody anywhere can see pictures from a show almost immediately. And basically what's happened is the customer has gotten really impatient. They get really excited about the clothes that they see, and then they're told that they have to wait 6 months before they can buy it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a broken model and it's not working.
So do you think everybody's going to follow Burberry and this is just the way it's going to be? You see it and boom, you can probably buy it right there at the show on your smartphone.
Well, it's funny. New York-based designer Rebecca Minkoff said in December that she was going to do this, that she was going to re-show her spring collection this season. And, you know, she's a smaller brand, a contemporary brand, and she announced that in December. And it was sort of a bold move for a smaller name to do that. And now a number of guys have come out and said, you know, we're going to do that too. The Council of Fashion Designers of America, which represents, you know, hundreds of designers here in the U.S., have said, you know, we're doing this study with Boston Consulting Group to kind of reimagine what a fashion show should be.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you know, from a business standpoint, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no,
these designers spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on these really flashy productions, and they get the customer really excited. So why wouldn't they want to try to make them buy as soon as possible?
Yeah, no, it totally does make sense. But there's something else going on here too, right? Because the brands and the designers are taking advantage of Instagram and social media, and some of them anyway, getting their looks out there before the show actually hits. And it's a little bit like Super Bowl ads, right? Because we saw Super Bowl ads online, you know, a week before the actual game. Are they stealing any of their own pizzazz, or is it all part of the same strategy, I guess?
Well, it's funny because just a couple of years ago, these brands were like, oh, no, no, you know, not social media. That's not glossy enough, you know, for our beautiful clothing. And now they've, you know, sort of come full circle where you're right. They preview things beforehand, you know, get people excited to watch their show and to tune in.
Yeah.
And I think it's sort of the democratization of fashion. The other element that's happening here and another reason why they're sort of speeding things up is the fast fashion players, the Zaras and the H&Ms of the world are able to copy this stuff really quickly. So within 6 weeks of a show happening, you can see that stuff show up in a Zara, whereas the designer might not have it for another, you know, 4 or 5 months.
One more thing and then I'll let you go. How long do you suppose until this whole idea of a fashion week and seasons of fashions just sort of goes away and these designers invent something and bam, it's out there and we don't have to go through the whole rigmarole of fashion week and, oh, we got to wait till fall, you know?
Well, I think seasonless dressing is a big topic that a lot of people are talking about. I also think that Fashion Week as an industry, you know, event is not going to be necessary, that all these designers are going to have private showroom appointments where they sort of wine and dine their buyers and editors that way. Hmm. And then for public consumption, they will still want to do something once or twice a year to kind of get people really excited.
Hmm.
The shoppers, that is, that, you know, that can come and open their wallets at the store. But yeah, this current model is, it's just not going to last.
Elizabeth Holmes covers fashion and retail for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
The conversation in higher education the past couple of months has been about diversity, about the lack of it, and the lack of awareness about the lack of it when you get right down to it. Among the bigger issues has been college faculties that are notably not diverse. Just 4% of full-time professors in this country are black, compared to about 15% of students. Our education correspondent Amy Scott has been looking into what drives that disparity and how some colleges are trying to change it. Today, she goes inside a campus at the University of Maryland to look at one piece of the puzzle, the hiring process. Here's Amy.
Tyson King Meadows loves a good sports metaphor. He's chair of the Africana Studies Department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And today he's using Michael Jordan and the 1984 NBA draft to make a point.
What number was Michael Jordan drafted? What number?
I have no idea.
Just get, what do you think? What do you think?
He was picked third.
Do we know who number one and number two were? That's the point. He will go down as one of the greatest basketball players of all time. But at that point, people had expectations that a taller player would be a better basketball player. Not necessarily.
This is not King Meadows' usual audience of undergrads. He's talking to fellow professors at UMBC in psychology, medieval history, and computer science. They're part of a special committee working to make the recruiting and hiring process more open and fair.
My point is that sometimes you have to look at the whole person.
King Meadows, the guest speaker, is the only African-American in the room. The committee is all white. But he says that's not an accident.
Well, we understand here at UMBC that the burden of inclusiveness should not rest on minority faculty.
Too often, King Meadows says it does, and that sometimes invisible service, serving on committees and mentoring students of color, can come at the expense of research and ultimately delay a minority professor's promotion and tenure. Medievalist Susan McDonough says there's another important reason for white faculty to advocate for diversity and call out bias.
The burden has to be more on the majority culture to do it more than we do it. I've seen it in my classrooms that when students of color point out bias, there's often a willingness to dismiss it that would not have been there if it had been a majority person who had shared that thought.
UMBC is actually known as one of the most diverse public research universities in the country. About half of its nearly 14,000 students are non-white, 16% are black, and so is its longtime president, Freeman Hrabowski. He also chairs President Obama's Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans.
Many people know us because we've had considerable success in educating students of all races in science and engineering. Our graduation and retention rates for African Americans and other students of color are as high as they are for any other group.
So it's all the more surprising that among the faculty, just 7% are black.
We're slightly ahead of the national average, but I would be the first to say that we're not where we want to be. And this is probably the highest strategic priority I have as provost.
Provost Philip Rouse says universities trying to increase diversity are drawing from a relatively small pool. Only about 6% of PhDs in 2013 were awarded to African Americans. But he says that's only part of the story.
Saying, well, you know, there's not enough people with PhDs isn't really a great excuse. Because even though the percentage may be small, there's still a lot of people out there.
Which brings us back to that committee of professors. One of them is Chris Murphy, chair of the psychology department. He says part of the group's job will be to train fellow professors to recognize the unconscious biases that can creep into the search process and unfairly weed out perfectly qualified candidates. Murphy has been through this kind of training himself. Let's say someone applying for a psychology job has published research on urban minority groups.
Other people might see that as kind of an advocacy rather than a scholarly approach. Or we have this phrase sometimes in psychology that research is me-search, so people kind of downgrade people who might be studying things that have a personal relevance to them.
Murphy says people are more likely to fall back on their first impressions and gut instincts when they're under time pressure to make a decision. In some searches, he says, a department will get 500 applications.
A lot of what happens is that people end up valuing people who look and look like themselves, think like themselves, and come from similar backgrounds, educationally and perhaps, you know, socially.
Murphy and his fellow committee members will also work with professors to rethink how they recruit. Just posting a job ad in the usual spots and waiting for CVs to roll in is no longer enough. Every open position, there were 29 tenured or tenure-track hires last year, must include a diversity plan, outlining specific steps for reaching underrepresented minorities. Even when there is no job opening, professors should be out there looking for young minority scholars on their way up, says Tyson King Meadows.
Talented minority faculty are not unicorns. They're there. It just depends on where you're looking. You have to look.
And you're more likely to find them, he says, if you're willing to look at yourself, too. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, another tip, oh, the hat to the smartest businesswoman in the world. We told you yesterday about Beyoncé and how she basically owned the buzz coming out of the Super Bowl with her new single, Formation, it's called, and the world tour and all that. Today, the wealth is being spread. Red Lobster, the seafood restaurant, gets, shall we say, a favorable mention in that song. It reported sales on Sunday were up 33% from a year earlier. All right. It has to do with sex, okay? That favorable mention. All right, sex. All right, out of here we are. The Dow off 12 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 14 points, about a 3%. The S&P 500 shaved off a single point. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, the senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. APM, this is.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.